You are listening to Serve, Protect, Lead, a podcast from the International Association of Chiefs of Police, where you will hear from IACP leadership and police leaders across the globe sharing wisdom, insight, and perspective.
Hello, everyone. My name is Christina Fernandez, and I am a program manager at the International Association of Chiefs of Police. Welcome to the IACP's Family Support, Training, and Technical Assistance Program podcast. Funded by the Motorola Solutions Foundation, this program provides individualized assistance and support to agencies as they develop or enhance their family wellness programs. As we know, family wellness is critical for resilient and healthy officers. Our focus today will be on critical incidents, how they can impact law enforcement children, how to talk to children about these incidents, and resources that can help. I'm very honored to be joined by Kimberly Jackson-Luzader, Law Enforcement Family Wellness Consultant, and Joanna Black, Chief Marketing and Communications Officer with the First Responder Children's Foundation. Welcome to you both, and thank you for taking the time and your willingness to share your knowledge and experience with us today. Let's go ahead and dive right in, and I'd love for each of you to just take a moment and introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about your work and your experience in this area. And Kimberly, I'm going to start with you.
Thank you for having us on this. I feel really appreciative for this opportunity. Like you said, my name is Kimberly Jackson-Luzader. I am a consultant for IACP. I also am the trauma counselor for the Raleigh Police Department. And I also facilitate our family wellness program, which is called Families Behind the Badge. My background clinically is I specialize in the treatment of trauma for children and have done that for about 10 to 12 years now.
Thank you for joining us today. And Joanna, tell us a little bit about yourself and about your organization.
Thank you so much, Christina, for having me. And thank you, Kimberly. And thank you, the IACP. You've been really wonderful partners to work with. First Responders Children's Foundation is a nonprofit organization that services families, first responder families, that is, on a national basis. We were founded 22 years ago after the tragic incidents of September 11th, when 800 children lost a first responder parent. And needless to say, through the years, we've seen many situations in which families have come to us for help. We provide programs and services, which include scholarships for children of first responders. We have our mental health resiliency program, which we're going to be speaking about today. We also have financial hardship grants, which include bereavement assistance to families. And we have an amazing community outreach program that is focused on bringing law enforcement and first responders closer to their communities. So I'm really excited about today's and thank you for having me.
We are very grateful to get to work with both of you. And I'm very, very grateful for you taking the time today. It's a difficult topic. And I think critical incidents, as we're seeing, especially incidents of mass violence, we're seeing so many more of these happening. You really can't get away from them. They're in the media, the images. We have to sort of think about not only the first responders that are addressing these incidents and they're in the midst of it, but how their kids view them and how their kids might be affected by knowing that their parents are going into these situations and what that feels like or looks like to them. So I'm going to start with Kimberly. If you could just talk a little bit about how do you think kids kind of view these incidents and what kind of effect could their knowledge that their parents are involved in these incidents, or maybe even just ongoing exposure in the media to them and being aware of them, what kind of effects are we thinking about for kids?
That is definitely a heavy question with, I think, a lot of information that could be shared behind it. When you think about the incidents that children are exposed to, there's a lot of things that go on social media and the news that probably heightens some of that worry that they experience. Or even how they find out these things are going on in the community that their officer is responding to or their parent. I think probably the younger kids are easier to shield from some of it, right? They don't have as much access to social media. Probably what we let them watch is, you know, very slim as far as the news. But then I also see with the adolescents is they have so much more access to things that are going on in the public. I even know of a family where the teenager tracks their parent. And so based on what's going on, they make that connection of, okay, you know, my parents probably responding to this. And so I think that probably adds in a level of anxiety based on how much you know of what your officer does. And so there's just such a large range of what, you know, children or adolescents will explain with their thoughts and feelings. It also depends on how the other parent that's home or the caregiver that's home with them maybe responds to those critical incidents as well. Based on what they find out, maybe an officer has called them or texted them to let them know what's going on in their area, and whether they're responding to it or whether they're not, probably starts that the pulse for the family. So I know a lot of families, if there's a critical incident going on and their officer isn't involved and they have the ability to text, that family is instantly relieved, right? They don't have to worry. They don't feel like they have to follow that incident. But if they don't hear that from a parent, as far as like, hey, you know, I'm not involved in this, and then they assume that their parent is involved in that critical incident, I think that heightens the anxiety, if that makes sense. Like them not knowing where their parent is can really maybe cause some different changes in their day-to-day. So definitely a lot of different thoughts and feelings that they experience.
That makes a lot of sense. And certainly it's easier to shield littler kids than it is to shield adolescents or teenagers who are so involved in social media, so aware of everything that's happening, so much more so than even we are. So those are really, really important points. And I'm going to just turn it over to Joanna for just a second. What kind of resources are available for children to kind of help them get through these critical times, children of law enforcement or first responder families?
Absolutely. You know, I will touch on something that Kimberly just mentioned, and that is the family's response and how the children deal with knowing that their family might be going into an incident. And we've actually seen that firsthand with some of our scholarship recipients. You know, they're now young adults, they're going off to college, and we hear their stories. And so many of those stories come back to exactly what Kimberly has to share, whether their parent is still alive or has deceased. And that is those very early memories, those early childhood memories that have made an impact on their lives. And they can recall each one of them, specific incidents when their family member was called in and they were sitting at home worrying if they'd come home, or in some situations, when there was school lockdowns or where the child knew that their parent was responding, and we hear those stories over and over again. So it does stay with the child over time. And, you know, when it comes to the First Responders Children's Foundation and our resiliency program, one of the reasons we actually launched this program pretty much in the middle of COVID, we started seeing when we launched our COVID-19 emergency response grant, we had over 20,000 applications that came in for that particular grant. And the purpose of that grant was to provide financial support to families on the front lines. We were paying for hotel rooms, food stipends. A big portion of this first responder community, especially in fire services, are volunteer. So they were losing their job and they had no way of paying their bills. So there was many touch points that we had during COVID. And one of the themes that we kept seeing reoccurring, and again, this is just during COVID, was the anxiety and the stress and the worry that the children had. And we knew that we had to do something. So we launched the resiliency program really as a beta, despite at the time, folks within both law enforcement and other areas of the first responder community saying, well, there's really not a need for this. We already have this covered with our internal resources. We went ahead and launched it as on a beta and quite quickly came to see that there was a need, and recognized with the initial data that we came through that some families really wanted to have an outside source for their children that was confidential. It was culturally competent, counselors that were also trauma informed and free. So we launched that program, and now we're about a year and a half into the program, actually probably closer to a year and 8 months into the program now. And we have now tracked real data, which never existed until this time. So I'll just pause now, because I'm sure Kimberly, you might have something to add to what I just said about the stories that we see, and then I can go into maybe a little bit about what these children are seeking services for.
I think it's great that you pointed out the change in things through COVID and the fact that you did the beta program, because we probably wouldn't have known this if not. And some of the things you did touch on is, you know, during the middle of COVID, what were the worries? And some of those worries were like, you know, their parent has to be out front lines with people who are sick. Obviously, law enforcement, you know, depending on what the situations are, you're going to have to be in close contact with other people. I remember somebody had their officers desanitized before coming into the house, and that worry that they might get sick and then cause the rest of the family to get sick, or some of those things that we didn't have to worry about in addition to, you know, the daily dangers that are out there for law enforcement. So I think it definitely compounded the stress that we're in families, is you're afraid of them already being out responding to incidents, and then now you have this other threat that's impacting so many people. And we know the fatality rate was so high during COVID. So like I said, it just piles on for them. So I think those are things when you talk about COVID that really stand out to me as very unique, that most people maybe didn't have that, besides maybe medical professionals and law enforcement. I think those were the big people at the forefront of COVID.
I appreciate that you're both talking about COVID so much, because originally, you know, we talked about this as being focusing on critical incidents, but COVID was a huge, huge impact on law enforcement. And, you know, a critical incident is kind of a acute, maybe intense, fearful thing that happens that kids are responding to, but COVID was over an extended period of time.
Right.
And certainly had different effects, but it's again, it kind of heightens that awareness for kids that my parents are going into the field, are going out and doing work that is even more dangerous than what typically they're already doing, which is already a dangerous profession. So I really appreciate that you're both kind of focusing on that. And Joanna, I know I wanted to get back to your comment about some of the requests that you're seeing or some of the need that arose as a result of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I just ran some data before we had this call, and you know, to date, so that's in a little over a year and a half, we provided over 1,200 hours of free confidential services to children and first responders. And we've serviced close to 240 children, 236 to be exact. So we have some data now that we never had. And what was interesting as we were putting this program together, we realized that since 9/11, there has been no real study done specifically on the mental health challenges of children of first responders. You know, they're a very unique group of individuals in themselves because they have a unique set of challenges unlike any others. So what we might see is just civilians and what our children are facing, you can actually layer on top of that so many additional stressors and worries that those children of first responders experience on a daily basis. Also, we recognize that their parents might have traumas, and that trauma is then passed on to other members of the household, which we call secondary trauma. And I'm sure Kimberly can speak to that very well. And what we realized was that out of this initial group that we have been tracking, 34.8% of the children are suffering from anxiety. Then we also have, that's almost cut in half again with depression. So we've got about 19.8% of those children dealing with depression. And then from there, we see coping skills is 11.1%. And then trauma and grief, both at around 6.6%. So we start seeing, you know, the numbers change also by the age group and the demographic. Now, what was really striking to me and shocking, I'm a mother with two young children, one being female, is that the numbers are almost double when it comes to girls and boys. So we're seeing almost double the amount of girls coming in for services, especially around anxiety and depression, than boys. So that was, you know, really interesting for us to see. And what this data is going to allow us to be able to do is actually help us and others within this field create additional resources specific to the services and the challenges that these children are facing, but also based on their gender, which is really exciting for us moving forward.
I always find that fascinating. Thank you for pointing that out. And I'm always curious to know, like, is it an indicator that female children are experiencing more stress, or that they're better at reaching out when they need help?
we don't know the answer yet. Kimberly might have that very answer, but we haven't dug deep enough yet to get the answer to that, but it's definitely something we'd love to explore. And the other data point that I failed to mention, and is very specific to the audience today, is that we are seeing double the amount of children from police officers coming in for services. And that's double with all the other groups combined, meaning fire, paramedic, dispatchers. We're seeing double the amount of children from police showing up for help.
That's another one where I think is that they are getting better at reaching out when they need help, which I think is, I'm going to look at it that way just to make myself feel better. But I think that's really interesting. Those numbers are really fascinating. And I think that's a lot for you all to delve into. That's a great foundation for more research and more just more knowledge about sort of what the landscape is looking like and how it's changing. So Joanna has talked about some of her organization's resources and what they can bring to bear in the aftermath of a critical incident, and then just day to day. But Kimberly, can you talk a little bit about what law enforcement agencies right now can do to sort of better support families and children in the aftermath of a critical incident? And taking into mind what you both said, which I thought was really important, is that the child's reaction is going to be based a lot on what the parent that's at home is experiencing. So better supporting them as well for sort of a better support system overall. So Kimberly, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's a great question as far as what they can start doing now. I'm big on kind of assessing what's going on. Even like Joanna's talking about, is having the data is helpful. And so when it comes to law enforcement families for a specific agency, it's really helpful to get a barometer versus assuming what those families need. And so that's the first place I feel like agencies can do and start is, you know, let's ask the families in some way, you know, what are they feeling? What are the thoughts that they have right now? And if they could have resources, what would that look like? I know I did that several years ago after my agency had a critical incident. And I remember the chief at the time goes, we have this going on. We have support for our officers. You know, we have all of these things, but what does the family need? And I really appreciated that she took the time to think about that. And so from there, we did kind of like a focus group. It was like, you know, come out, let's talk about what you're experiencing. Let's give you some coping tools like right out the gate so you have something to take home with you. And then give me some feedback afterwards. And some of that feedback was, we need a network. We need to know other people. So when things like this happen, we have people to turn to. Just they want a communication from the department, which for me, I was like, that's easy. Start giving me your emails and then I'll figure out what we can send to you and when we can send it. And so I think without having those conversations, you really don't know. And it's like playing darts with a blinder on, is how good are you going to be if you can't see? And that's where we need to start with, is your family is going to tell you what they need and they'll be the best advocate for themselves as well. And I think Christina, you kind of maybe pointed to this as well, but there's trainings that could be put in place that would help parents, which then can go trickle down to that family and really help support their children. When we think about like trauma-focused interventions, a lot of that is on the parent. And that's just because we hope that they've had life experiences and have started to develop their own coping tools, but we also want to make sure that they're developing healthy coping skills that they can pass on to their children, that they have enough psychoeducation to know what's going on and when they see certain behaviors, what can they do? So I feel like agencies could definitely partner with mental health agencies and experts in the field to start offering that. I know in this area, we have a lot of universities with people that specialize in trauma, and they love coming out and doing webinars based on what they've learned in their interactions with working with children. So I think really tapping into those community resources that are very valuable, like Joanna mentioned, that are, you know, culturally competent, have that background working with traumatic incidents, is a great resource. I also feel like some of it is just bringing families together and to know that in your department, there are people that care, there's relationships you can build. That gives you just a little bit more comfort when things are going on. You just know like, okay, at the end of the day, I know the chief puts me first because, you know, she's made me feel this way, or I know she cares about my officer. She has a chief, but a chief also, you know, males. But yeah, I think that starts with the culture too, is, you know, what foundation can an agency put out there that shows families that they're significant and that, you know, you can also support them.
Kimberly, I think that's a really good point, and it brings something to mind immediately. And that was actually recently, we spoke in a panel at the IACP conference in San Diego, and we invited some chiefs to join us on that panel. We had Chief Michael Moore from LAPD. We also had Chief Booker Hodges, and we had retired Chief Renee Hall. And all of them had very specific personal examples of how these critical incidents have impacted not just their own families, but also those within their agencies. And what's essential, whether you're a small agency or a large agency like the LAPD, is that leadership really takes charge in having an open conversation about the mental resiliency of their officers as well as the families. In this situation, Chief Michael Moore actually went as far as recording a video for our foundation around the weight of the badge and what the weight of the badge means to not only his officers, but to the families, and really imploring his officers to utilize these services and endorsing that these services have been recommended by the department for the families. Because what we have found is often when we'll go into an agency, there could be a little bit of uncertainty is what's the catch. I often say, you know, people kind of raise their eyebrows and say, well, it's free, it's confidential, no questions asked, what's the catch? And the reality is there is no catch. We as a foundation are here to service the families. The other point that I'd like to make is like mental health should be top of mind, no pun intended, year round, not just during the month of May when it's National Mental Health Awareness Month. There should be an ongoing dialogue, as Kimberly had said, within the agencies and bringing resources to the table on an ongoing basis to really start to destigmatize the topic of mental health, because let's face it, there is still a stigma that exists. And it's getting better. And just going back to COVID, I think because of COVID, it has become better because more people are talking in the media and everywhere you look, we're talking and hearing about the national mental health crisis. So we're not alone. A police officer and their family is no longer alone talking about these challenges. Their challenges might be more unique or exaggerated because of their job, but they're not alone because every family is dealing with some sort of mental health situation as a result of, it didn't exist before, certainly as a result of COVID.
So important. Such good information you both are sharing. Thank you so much. One thing I wanted to kind of loop back around to is we talk about family wellness a lot more now in terms of law enforcement. And that was not a conversation that was as front of mind many years ago as it is now, which is a wonderful trend to see. And I think in some cases, you know, law enforcement, they want to shield their families as much as possible. They don't want to give them too much information or sort of scare them in a way that could traumatize them further. So I wanted to kind of talk to you both about sort of how do we find that line? And especially as it pertains to talking to children about what their parents do, about critical incidents, about things that are happening. How do we know if it's too much? Like, where do we stop and sort of say, let them ask questions if they want to know, but at the same time, make sure they're aware of what's happening and they're not sort of blindsided by things. Kimberly, I want to start with you.
You're asking some great questions today.
I'm asking too many questions and I know, I'm sorry.
No, we want that. That's the only way we'll learn. Yes, we learn so much by questions. I was just thinking last night at dinner, my daughter asked 100 questions about everything at this age. And she's so inquisitive that you have to think like, okay, one, I love that she's answering questions, but really, how do I answer those questions that's going to be beneficial for her, but also not traumatizing? And so she's not necessarily a law enforcement child, but she sees what's going on. And so some of the examples she had last night was there was a critical incident that happened in our community that resulted in a fatality of a child. And she started asking a lot of questions about it. So it's wanting to figure out you're giving thoughtful answers versus just throwing it out there and realizing later, like, oh, maybe that was too much. So one of the advice I give to parents is, yeah, you want to answer questions as honest and appropriate as you can, based on their developmental stages, but it's okay to buy yourself some time. And I've had to do that too. It's like, you know, I don't really know the answer to that. Can I think about that for a little bit so that I have time to process to give back a better response? And so that's something that parents probably don't think that they can do, but it's better to buy yourself time versus reacting in the moment and not being able to think about your own thoughts and feelings in the situation, because those could be biased or not helpful. So that's a big thing. The communication, keeping the door open with them so that they know whether they're asking questions or whether they just want to talk about what they're feeling, I think is giving them that space. And then obviously keeping out gory details, but enough that their mind doesn't start to wander. That's another thing that I like to talk to parents about is the way our brains work is we're going to fill in the gaps. And with my children or the other children I care about, I'm like, I'd rather them coming to me as a source versus listening to the other people that are around them. And so really establishing, you know, come to me, even if I can't answer the question, I'd rather us talk about it and then figure it out together versus you listening to some kid that you met at school that doesn't know what they're talking about, but they're just talking about what they've heard other people say. So once you have those lines of communication, I think you'll probably know better what to share with your kids and maybe what not to share with them. And if in doubt, reach out to a professional that can help you. There's so many culturally competent therapists, educators that, you know, will always give some tidbits.
Thank you. I think that's a great lead in. So Joanne, I'm going to ask you that question and talk a little bit about culturally competent support and why it's so important.
Well, thank you. Absolutely. When we worked on this program, we interviewed many psychologists from across the country and also professionals in law enforcement and firefighting. And one of the areas that prevented some of them on seeking counseling for their children or not returning to counseling was because the therapist that they were seeing just did not understand the specific and unique needs of that family and what they're dealing with. So they were just not connected with the right person who could listen and understand. So we knew that when we created this program, that the counselors that would be working alongside us would need to have that level of expertise. And what we do when we're working with counselors, we obviously vet them, make sure that they do have that training when it comes to culturally competent. But we also provide them additional training so that everyone is on the same level. So we know that we have ourselves a baseline that anyone who comes through or comes to one of our counselors for support, that those counselors have gone through this specific training with us. And then they, every quarter, we have additional resources and additional trainings for those counselors to participate in. And we go as far as encouraging them to partner with their local police departments to do ride-alongs, to actually go and meet with some of the families just in a very, you know, community events and just get familiar with what it's like to walk in the shoes of that first responder family. So, you know, there's the training and then there's the hands-on work too that we really encourage them to do. And as part of our training, there's also opportunities for them to share experiences and to talk about trends. And, you know, there are trends. There's trends when it comes to what's happening in this world. You know, when you turn on the TV, the different types of reactions that the children will have are different from month to month, from year to year. So we really do encourage that they talk amongst themselves, they share experiences, and that we also have an open line of dialogue between our organization and our professional counselors and psychologists to reach out to us and to share and to ask questions. But it's essential. I mean, culturally competent. And the other thing that we found is not every shoe always fits. And we let families know that you will have a match with a counselor, but if it doesn't fit, we will find somebody that fits and that works for your family. So no two families are unique and no two counselors are unique. So ideally, you know, we typically find a pretty good match right away, but there has been situations where a family might have wanted to change out just because of difference in personalities or just didn't feel right. And that's okay too. It doesn't mean you should just walk away and leave it as is.
Absolutely. I think that's such an important point that it's okay to say this isn't the right fit for me, but that doesn't mean that I no longer need the support and counseling. It's just this wasn't the right combination of personalities or experience, and that's so key. And I want to kind of loop back around a little bit because I think we are seeing so much more conversation around family wellness and officer mental health, which is wonderful and what we want. But I think it also brings forth perhaps a lot more professionals who want to help and maybe have the best of intentions, but may not be culturally competent, to your point, Joanna, and may not be a fit for that agency or for that type of work. So Kimberly, I'm going to turn it to you for just a second and just ask you, you know, what are some things that maybe agencies can kind of keep in mind as they're trying to look for a good counselor or someone who could work with them? And if that approach isn't taken, sort of what's the harm that could happen if it's not a good match, or if it's a professional that just may not be suited for that type of work or have the right experience?
Definitely. It's such a big challenge because for me, it's like, I remember when I was a therapist, you know, they always said green out of school and you don't have all that experience. Like your graduate education is going to give you a foundation, but it's not going to always be trauma-informed. You might get that course on trauma-informed counseling, but then it has to be that professional that seeks it out. And so I think for young professionals that would want to work with law enforcement, they have a little bit of time to be able to develop those skills, but we still want to give them opportunities. So I feel like one, just in general, agencies giving more thought to maybe internships so those therapists can begin to have those life experiences. But even if they don't have the right fit, like Joanna has talked about programs that will help prepare them. And then that might be as you're vetting to say, hey, you know, I see you're building your resume. You have some great work here, but you know, you might not be a good fit right now, but I would like to enroll you in one of these programs. And so I think we want to develop that profession, especially as law enforcement is growing. We're going to need more therapists that understand law enforcement. So I think that's from a development standpoint is, you know, we want to give therapists a chance to grow and learn so that they can give back to law enforcement in a way that's competent. Hopefully that answers one part of the question. I think there was another piece that I might've went on a tangent on with their piece.
The question was really just about what kind of harm could happen, or you know, what is the downside, I guess, of maybe involving a counselor, a therapist that doesn't have that background, that doesn't have that experience.
Yeah, so I think some of the harm that I've seen in those situations is therapists wanting to help, and like you said, they don't have maybe the best background to it, and so it's that first shot to show someone what counseling can be like, and if you blow that with people that are already hesitant, then you might not be able to get them back in the door. And so we do see that. I've had people who said my first session with a therapist, she started crying uncontrollably. We can't have that in our profession. Like, yes, you're going to have some level of emotion and you want to have that to be empathetic and validate people. But if you can't have your emotions in a healthy way during those sessions, it's not going to be effective. And so we don't want to burn that relationship before it even has the chance to grow. So yeah, that would be one of the things is after that, they're not likely to seek help because of maybe a negative first reaction.
Yeah, and definitely to that point, Kimberly, what we've seen and heard stories of when a counselor is not culturally competent, they just don't understand the pressures of the job and the long hours that police officers have. They often have to do double shifts. The agencies are already stressed out just with people resources, that there's more pressure on their staff to work longer hours. And I've heard a few stories now in which the counselor, and one of the reasons these families may not have gone on to get additional counseling was that the counselor recommended, well, why don't you just have a date night? Or why don't you just have a family day every Saturday, put it on the calendar just to be with the family? But they're completely unfamiliar with the job and the pressures of the job and the hours, because police officers work shifts. They work nights, they work days, they work weekends, they work birthday parties, they work Christmases, they work Thanksgivings, and they just don't understand that. So that actually gets in the way of them being able to provide real solutions or recommendations to help that family.
And Very important considerations. And it's, yeah, absolutely. It's a unique job, and not everybody understands all those nuances. And that's why this is so very important. So we're going to start wrapping up. So I'm going to ask each of you two questions. And the first question is, what is the one thing that you would like law enforcement agencies to understand as it pertains to the needs of law enforcement children, especially around traumatic incidents? And the second question is, what is one thing that law enforcement agencies can do right now to prepare for these incidents and support the children and families? So a takeaway from today's session. So Joanna, I'm going to start with you.
Great. Well, I think that we've touched on both of these questions already. So I'll just reemphasize that number one, officers are part of a community. They're not alone. Their families are not alone. So definitely tap into your brothers and sisters within law enforcement for support. And if a dialogue is not already happening within your agency, start having that dialogue. Bring the resources that I'm going to talk about now to those within your agency, so your chief or other folks within the agency who can support getting the word out, and be an advocate for the mental health of your children. We're advocates for so many other things in their lives, you know, whether it be around school or sports. Mental health is just as important, and our children need a cheerleader and a person to advocate for them. So it's no different within your own agency as it would be to any other thing that you do for your child on a daily basis. Number two, when it comes to resources, I would encourage everyone listening to check out our website, which is the number one, strcf.org. So that's 1strcf.org. Or you can just Google us, First Responders Children's Foundation. And under programs, you will see the resiliency program. The program, as I said, is free, confidential, trauma-informed. There's a really short questionnaire that you can fill out to get more information. And we will have somebody contact you within 48 hours, guaranteed. So that is number one. Even if you're just considering utilizing the services, just to take the first step, that's the most important step, is taking that first step. And then you can determine from there if the program is a fit for your family. And we are growing this program. So we really do invite, and we have resources designated for this program. So we really do encourage you to partake in it.
It's so helpful. Thank you so much for sharing that. Kimberly, I'm going to ask you the same two questions.
Thank you. I like to say what Joanna is saying is, you know, finding the resources. And I think that's a great takeaway, is making sure you research and use those resources and have them readily accessible. Things I want agencies to understand about children is their needs are so unique. Not only are they singled into this law enforcement family piece, but they're going to each have different needs within being a law enforcement family. So once again, don't assume. Take the time to figure out best practices in your area for children and have those things kind of in a resource. I don't even know what you say, like maybe not necessarily a booklet, because you don't want to give them a booklet, but just have those tools in your back pocket, so when they're needed, you can provide those. I think one thing I would like families to really consider as their takeaway, and maybe not even the families, it's taking it back to the agency, is begin to establish that family network now before you have a crisis. There's nothing worse than having to scurry together just to be able to figure out what those families need, like what my agency experienced many, many years ago. Is now today, it's like you have the foundation there, and then you can respond so much quicker to the needs of families. So I hope agencies will consider getting that network in place sooner rather than later.
Thank you. So as we close out today's podcast, I would like to thank our guests, Kimberly Jackson-Luzader and Joanna Black. I want to thank you both for your honesty and your insight and the resources that you share. This was such an important conversation, and I'm so grateful that we had that conversation with you both. I wanted to thank the Motorola Solutions Foundations and the International Association of Chiefs of Police Family Support Training and Technical Assistance Program for the opportunity to have this very important discussion today. For more information about the IACP's Officer and Safety Wellness Resources, please visit our webpage at theiacp.org/OSW or email us at osw@theiacp.org. Thank you and be well. This podcast was supported by Motorola Solutions Foundation as part of the IACP's Family Support Training and Technical Assistance Program. As always, the opinions contained in this podcast are those of the speakers and not the official position or policies of Motorola Solutions Foundation or the IACP. Reference to specific individuals, agencies, companies, products, or services should not be considered an endorsement by the speakers, IACP, or Motorola Solutions Foundation. Rather, the references are illustrations to supplement discussion of the issues. Thanks for listening to today's episode. You can visit learn.theiacp.org/podcast to view the transcript from today's episode and to find additional ways to learn from leaders in the field.